Hello, I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opianga Line. First off, a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you, one and all, our beloved subscribers and podcast listeners from all around the globe. Today, in honor of this holiday season, we are joined by Jeff Bowman, Kathy Chapesky, Karen and Rob Filipkowski, Carolyn Brian Peterson, Lynn Stewart, and Mark Wormke, all members of the Opianga Readers Theatre, and all here with their very own Christmas present, just for you. It's a show called Christmas with Ms. Montgomery. That title might not mean much until you understand the Ms. Montgomery in question is none other than Lucy Maud Montgomery. Many of you will know her as the world-famous author of Anne of Green Gables, truly one of Canada's great literary exports. What many people may not know about Lucy Maud Montgomery is that beyond her international reputation as a stellar children's writer of 20 wonderful novels, she also wrote a whopping 530 short stories, mostly for magazines and newspapers throughout the English-speaking world. And, as it so happens, more than a few of those short stories deal with Christmas. So, the Opianga Readers Theatre thought it very appropriate to voice, for your listening pleasure today, as many as of Ms. Montgomery's Christmas stories as possible. Now it's time to sit back and enjoy a good old-fashioned late 19th and early 20th century Canadian Christmas. Here's Kathy Chapesky reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's A Christmas Mistake.
"Tomorrow is Christmas," announced Teddy Grant exultantly, as he sat on the floor struggling manfully with a refractory bootlace that was knotted and tagless and stubbornly refused to go into the eyelets of Teddy's patched boots. "Ain't I glad, though! Hurrah!" His mother was washing the breakfast dishes in a dreary, listless sort of way. She looked tired and broken-spirited. Ted's enthusiasm seemed to grate on her, for she answered sharply. "Christmas, indeed! I can't see that it is anything for us to rejoice over. Other people may be glad enough, but what with winter coming on, I'd sooner it was spring than Christmas. Oh, Mary Alice, do lift that child out of the ashes and put its shoes and stockings on. Everything seems to be at sixes and sevens here this morning." Keith, the oldest boy, was coiled up on the sofa, calmly working out some algebra problems, quite oblivious to the noise around him. But he looked up from his slate, with his pencil suspended above an obstinate equation, to declaim with a flourish, "Christmas comes but once a year, and then Mother wishes it wasn't here." "I don't then," said Gordon, son number two, who was preparing his own noon lunch of bread and molasses at the table and making an atrocious mess of crumbs and sugary syrup over everything. "I know one thing to be thankful for, and that is that there'll be no school. We'll have a whole week of holidays." Gordon was noted for his aversion to school and his affection for holidays. "And we're going to have turkey for dinner," declared Teddy, getting up off the floor and rushing to secure his share of bread and molasses. "And cranberry sauce and pound cake, ain't we, Ma?" "No, you are not," said Mrs. Grant desperately, dropping the dishcloth and snatching the baby on her knee to wipe the crust of cinders and molasses from the chubby pink and white face. "You may as well know it now, children. I've kept it from you so far in hopes that something would turn up, but nothing has. We can't have any Christmas dinner tomorrow. We can't afford it. I pinched and saved every way I could for the last month, hoping that I'd be able to get a turkey for you anyhow. But you'll have to do without it. There's that doctor's bill to pay and a dozen other bills coming in, and people say they can't wait. I suppose they can't, but it's kind of hard, I must say." The little Grant stood with open mouths and horrified eyes. "No turkey for Christmas? Was the world coming to an end? Wouldn't the government interfere if anyone ventured to dispense with a Christmas celebration?" The gluttonous Teddy stuffed his fists into his eyes and lifted up his voice. Keith, who understood better than the others the look on his mother's face, took his blubbering young brother by the collar and marched him into the porch. The twins, seeing the summary proceeding, swallowed the outcries they had intended to make, although they couldn't keep a few big tears from running down their fat cheeks. Mrs. Grant looked pityingly at the disappointed faces about her. "Don't cry, children. You make me feel worse. We are not the only ones who will have to do without a Christmas turkey. We ought to be very thankful that we have anything to eat at all. I hate to disappoint you, but it can't be helped."
"Never mind, Mother," said Keith comfortingly, relaxing his hold upon the porch door, whereupon it suddenly flew open and precipitated Teddy, who had been tugging at the handle, heels over head backwards. "We know you've done your best. It's been a hard year for you. Just wait, though. I'll soon be grown up, and then you and these greedy youngsters shall feast on turkey every day of the year. Hello, Teddy. Have you got on your feet again?
Mind, sir, no more blubbering."
"When I'm a man," announced Teddy with dignity, "I'd just like to see you put me in the porch. And I mean to have turkey all the time, and I won't give you any either."
"All right, you greedy small boy. Only take yourself off to school now, and let us hear no more squeaks out of you. Tramp, all of you, and give Mother a chance to get her work done."
Mrs. Grant got up and fell to work at her dishes with a brighter face.
"Well, we mustn't give in. Perhaps things will be better after a while. I'll make a famous bread pudding, and you can boil some molasses taffy and ask those little Smithsons next door to help you pull it. They won't whine for turkey, I'll be bound. I don't suppose they ever tasted such a thing in all their lives. If I could afford it, I'd have had them all in to dinner with us. That sermon Mr. Evans preached last Sunday kind of stirred me up. He said we ought always to try and share our Christmas joy with some poor souls who had never learned the meaning of the word. I can't do as much as I'd like to. It was different when your father was alive." The noisy group grew silent, as they always did when their father was spoken of. He had died the year before, and since his death, the little family had had a hard time. Keith, to hide his feelings, began to hector the rest.
"Mary Alice, do hurry up. Here, you twin nuisances, get off to school. If you don't, you'll be late, and then the master will give you a whipping."
"He won't," answered the irrepressible Teddy. "He never whips us, he doesn't. He stands us on the floor sometimes, though," he added, remembering the many times his own chubby legs had been seen to better advantage on the school platform.
"That man," said Mrs. Grant, alluding to the teacher, "makes me nervous. He is the most abstracted creature I ever saw in my life. It is a wonder to me he doesn't walk straight into the river some day. You'll meet him meandering along the street, gazing into vacancy, and he'll never see you nor hear a word you say half the time."
"Yesterday," said Gordon, chuckling over the remembrance, "he came in with a big piece of paper he'd picked up on the entry floor in one hand and his hat in the other. And he stuffed his hat into the coal scuttle and hung up the paper on a nail, as grave as you please. Never knew the difference till Ned Slocum went and told him. He's always doing things like that."
Keith had collected his books and now marched his brothers and sisters off to school. Left alone with the baby, Mrs. Grant betook herself to her work with a heavy heart. But a second interruption broke the progress of her dishwashing. "I declare," she said, with a surprised glance through the window, "if there isn't that absent-minded schoolteacher coming through the yard. What can he want? Oh, dear me, I do hope Teddy hasn't been cutting capers in school again." For the teacher's last call had been in October and had been occasioned by the fact that the irrepressible Teddy would persist in going to school with his pockets filled with live crickets and in driving them harnessed to strings up and down the aisle when the teacher's back was turned.
All mild methods of punishment having failed, the teacher had called to talk it over with Mrs. Grant, with the happy result that Teddy's behavior had improved, in the matter of crickets at least. But it was about time for another outbreak. Teddy had been unnaturally good for too long a time. Poor Mrs. Grant feared that it was the calm before a storm, and it was with nervous haste that she went to the door and greeted the young teacher. He was a slight, pale, boyish-looking fellow with an abstracted, musing look in his large, dark eyes. Mrs. Grant noticed with amusement that he wore a white straw hat in spite of the season. His eyes were directed to her face with his usual unseeing gaze, just as though he was looking through me at something 1,000 miles away, said Mrs. Grant afterwards. I believe he was, too. His body was right there on the step before me, but where his soul was is more than you or I or anybody can tell. Good morning, he said absently. I have just called on my way to school with a message from Miss Miller. She wants you all to come up and have Christmas dinner with her tomorrow. For the land's sake, said Mrs. Grant blankly, I don't understand. To herself, she thought, I wish I dared take him and shake him to find if he's walking in his sleep or not. You and all the children, every one, went on the teacher dreamily, as if he were reciting a lesson learned beforehand. She told me to tell you to be sure and come. Shall I say that you will? Oh, yes, that is, I suppose... I don't know, said Mrs. Grant incoherently. I never expected. Yes, you may tell her we'll come, she concluded abruptly. Thank you, said the abstracted messenger, gravely lifting his hat and looking squarely through Mrs. Grant into unknown regions. When he had gone, Mrs. Grant went in and sat down, laughing in a sort of hysterical way. I wonder if it is all right. Could Cornelia really have told him? She must, I suppose, but it is enough to take one's breath. Mrs. Grant and Cornelia Miller were cousins and had once been the closest of friends, but that was years ago, before some spiteful reports and ill-natured gossip had come between them, making only a little rift at first that soon widened into a chasm of coldness and alienation. Therefore, this invitation surprised Mrs. Grant greatly. Miss Cornelia was a maiden lady of certain years, with a comfortable bank account and a handsome old-fashioned house on the hill behind the village. She always boarded the school teachers and looked after them maternally. She was an active church worker and a tower of strength to struggling ministers and their families. If Cornelia has seen fit at last to hold out the hand of reconciliation, I'm glad enough to take it. Dear knows I've wanted to make up often enough, but I didn't think she ever would. We've both of us got too much pride and stubbornness. It's the Turner blood in us that does it. The Turners were all so set. But I mean to do my part now she has done hers. And Mrs. Grant made a final attack on the dishes with a beaming face. When the little Grants came home and heard the news, Teddy stood on his head to express his delight. The twins kissed each other and Mary Alice and Gordon danced around the kitchen. Keith thought himself too big to betray any joy over a Christmas dinner, but he whistled while doing the chores until the bear welkin in the yard rang. And Teddy, in spite of unheard-of misdemeanors, was not collared off into the porch once. When the young teacher got home from school that evening, he found the yellow house full of all sorts of delectable odors. Miss Cornelia herself was concocting mince pies after the famous family recipe, while her ancient and faithful handmaiden, Hannah, was straining into molds the cranberry jelly. The open pantry door revealed a tempting array of Christmas delicacies. "Did you call and invite the Smithsons up to dinner, as I told you?" asked Miss Cornelia anxiously. "Yes," was the dreamy response as he glided through the kitchen and vanished into the hall. Miss Cornelia crimped the edges of her pies delicately with a relieved air. "I made certain he'd forget it," she said. "You just have to watch him as if he were a mere child. Didn't I catch him yesterday starting off to school in his carpet slippers? And in spite of me, he got away today in that ridiculous summer hat. You'd better set that jelly in the out pantry to cool, Hannah. It looks good. We'll give those poor little Smithsons a feast for once in their lives if they never get another." At this juncture, the hall door flew open and Mr. Palmer appeared on the threshold. He seemed considerably agitated, and for once his eyes had lost their look of space searching. "Miss Miller, I am afraid I did make a mistake this morning. It has just dawned on me. I am almost sure that I called at Mrs. Grant's and invited her and her family instead of the Smithsons, and she said they would come." Miss Cornelia's face was a study. "Mr. Palmer," she said, flourishing her crimping fork tragically, "do you mean to say you went and invited Linda Grant here tomorrow? Linda Grant, of all the women in this world!" "I did," said the teacher with penitent wretchedness. "It was very careless of me. I am very sorry. What can I do? I'll go down and tell them I made a mistake, if you like." "Oh, you can't do that," groaned Miss Cornelia, sitting down and wrinkling up her forehead in dire perplexity. "It would never do in the world. For pity's sake, let me think for a minute." Miss Cornelia did think, to good purpose, evidently, for her forehead smoothed out as her meditations proceeded and her face brightened. Then she got up briskly. "Well, you've done it, and no mistake. I don't know that I'm sorry either. Anyhow, we'll leave it as it is. But you must go straight down now and invite the Smithsons too, and for pity's sake, don't make any more mistakes." When he had gone, Miss Cornelia opened her heart to Hannah. "I never could have done it myself, never. The Turner is too strong in me, but I'm glad it is done. I've been wanting for years to make up with Linda, and now the chance has come. Thanks to that blessed blundering boy, I mean to make the most of it. Mind, Hannah, you never whisper a word about its being a mistake. Linda must never know." Poor Linda. She's had a hard time. Hannah, we must make some more pies, and I must go straight down to the store and get some more Santa Claus stuff. I've only got enough to go around the Smithsons. When Mrs. Grant and her family arrived at the Yellow House next morning, Miss Cornelia herself ran out bareheaded to meet them. The two women shook hands a little stiffly, and then a rill of long-repressed affection trickled out from some secret spring in Miss Cornelia's heart, and she kissed her newfound old friend tenderly. Linda returned the kiss warmly, and both felt that the old-time friendship was theirs again. The little Smithsons all came, and they and the little Grants sat down on the long, bright dining room to a dinner that made history in their small lives and was eaten over again in happy dreams for months. How those children did eat, and how beaming Miss Cornelia and grim-faced, soft-hearted Hannah and even the absent-minded teacher himself enjoyed watching them. After dinner, Miss Cornelia distributed among the delighted little souls the presents she had bought for them, and then turned them loose in the big shining kitchen to have a taffy pull, and they had it to their heart's content. And as for the shocking taffy-fied state into which they got their own rosy faces and that once immaculate domain, well, as Miss Cornelia and Hannah never said one word about it, neither will I. The four women enjoyed the afternoon in their own way, and the school teacher buried himself in algebra to his own great satisfaction.
When her guests went home in the starlit December dusk, Miss Cornelia walked part of the way with them and had a long confidential talk with Mrs. Grant. When she returned, it was to find Hannah groaning in and over the kitchen, and the schoolteacher dreamily trying to clean some molasses off his boots with the kitchen hairbrush. Long-suffering Miss Cornelia rescued her property and dispatched Mr. Palmer into the woodshed to find the shoe brush. Then she sat down and laughed. Hannah, what will become of that boy yet? There's no counting on what he'll do next. I don't know how he'll ever get through the world, I'm sure, but I'll look after him while he's here at least. I owe him a huge debt of gratitude for this Christmas blunder. What an awful mess this place is in! But Hannah, did you ever in the world see anything so delightful as that little Tommy Smithson stuffing himself with plum cake, not to mention Teddy Grant? It did me good just to see them.
That was Kathy Chepesky reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's A Christmas Mistake. Next up is Rob Filipkowski reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's Christmas on Enderley Road.
Phil, I'm getting fearfully hungry. When are we going to strike civilization? The speaker was my chum, Frank Ward. We were home from our academy for the Christmas holidays and had been amusing ourselves on this sunshiny December afternoon by a tramp through the backlands, as the barrens that swept away south behind the village were called. They were grown over with scrub maple and spruce, and were quite pathless save for meandering sheep tracks that crossed and recrossed, but led apparently nowhere. Frank and I didn't know exactly where we were, but the backlands were not so extensive but that we would come out somewhere if we kept on. It was getting late, and we wished to go home. I have an idea that we ought to strike civilization somewhere up the Enderley Road pretty soon, I answered. Do you call that civilization? Said Frank, with a laugh. No Blackburn Hill boy was ever known to miss an opportunity of flinging a slur at Enderley Road, even if no Enderley Roader were by to feel the sting. Enderley Road was a miserable little settlement, straggling back from Blackburn Hill. It was a forsaken-looking place, and the people, as a rule, were poor and shiftless. Between Blackburn Hill and Enderley Road, very little social intercourse existed. And as the road people resented what they called the pride of Blackburn Hill, there was a good deal of bad feeling between the two districts. Presently, Frank and I came out on the Enderley Road. We sat on the fence a few minutes to rest and discuss our route home. If we go by the road, it's 3 miles, said Frank. Isn't there a shortcut? There ought to be one by the wood lane that comes out by Jacob Hart's, I answered, but I don't know where to strike it. Here's someone coming now. We'll inquire, said Frank, looking up the curve of the hard frozen road. The someone was a little girl of about 10 years old who was trotting along with a basket full of schoolbooks on her arm. She was a pale, pinched little thing, and her jacket and red hood seemed very old and thin. Hello, Missy, I said as she came up. And then I stopped, for I saw she'd been crying. "What's the matter?" asked Frank, who was much more at ease with children than I was, and had always a warm spot in his heart for their small troubles. "Has your teacher kept you in for being naughty?" The mite dashed her little red knuckles across her eyes and answered indignantly, "No, indeed. I stayed after school with Minnie Lawler to sweep the floor." "And did you and Minnie quarrel, and is that why you're crying?" asked Frank solemnly. "Minnie and I never quarrel. I'm crying because we can't have the school decorated on Monday for the examination, after all. The Dickies have gone back on us. After promising, too." And the tears began to swell up in the blue eyes again. "Very bad behavior on the part of the Dickies," commented Frank. "But can't you decorate the school without them?" "Why, of course not. They're the only big boys in the school. They said they would cut the boughs and bring a ladder tomorrow and help us nail the wreaths up, and now they won't. And everything is spoiled, and Miss Davis will be so disappointed." By dint of questioning, Frank soon found out the whole story. The semi-annual public examination was to be held on Monday afternoon, the day before Christmas. Miss Davis had been drilling her little flock for the occasion, and a program of recitations, speeches, and dialogues had been prepared. Our small informant, whose name was Maggie Bates, together with Minnie Lawler and several other little girls, had conceived the idea that it would be a fine thing to decorate the schoolroom with greens. For this, it was necessary to ask the help of the boys. Boys were scarce at Enderley School, but the Dickies, three in number, had promised to see that the thing was done. "And now they won't," sobbed Maggie. "Matt Dickey is mad at Miss Davis, 'cause she stood him on the floor today for not learning his lesson. And he says he won't do a thing, nor let any of the other boys help us. Matt just makes all the boys do as he says. I feel dreadful bad, and so does Minnie." "Well, I wouldn't cry any more about it," said Frank consolingly. "Crying won't do any good, you know. Can you tell us where to find the wood lane that cuts across to Blackburn Hill?" Maggie could, and gave us minute directions. So, having thanked her, we left her to pursue her disconsolate way and betook ourselves homeward. "I would like to spoil Matt Dickey's little game," said Frank. "He's evidently trying to run things at Enderley Road School and revenge himself on the teacher. Let's put a spoke in his wheel and do Maggie a good turn as well." "Agreed. But how?" Frank had a plan ready to hand, and when we reached home, we took his sisters, Carrie and Mabel, into our confidence. And the four of us worked to such good purpose all the next day, which was Saturday, that by night everything was in readiness. At dusk, Frank and I set out for the Enderley Road, carrying a basket, a small stepladder, an unlit lantern, a hammer, and a box of tacks. It was dark when we reached the Enderley Road schoolhouse. Fortunately, it was quite out of sight of any inhabited spot, being surrounded by woods. Hence, mysterious lights in it at strange hours would not be likely to attract attention. The door was locked, but we easily got in by a window, lighted our lantern, and went to work. The schoolroom was small, and the old-fashioned furniture bore marks of hard usage, but everything was very snug, and the carefully swept floor and dusted desks bore testimony to the neatness of our small friend Maggie and her chub Minnie. Our basket was full of mottos made from letters cut out of cardboard and covered with lissome sprays of fur. They were, moreover, adorned with gorgeous pink and red tissue roses, which Carrie and Mabel had contributed. We had considerable trouble in getting them tacked up properly, but when we had succeeded, and had furthermore surmounted doors, windows, and blackboard with wreaths of green, the little Enderley Road schoolroom was quite transformed. "It looks nice," said Frank, in a tone of satisfaction. "Hope Maggie will like it." We swept up the litter we had made and then scrambled out the window. "I'd like to see Matt Dickey's face when he comes Monday morning," I laughed, as we struck into the backlands. "I'd like to see that midget of a Maggie's," said Frank. "See here, Phil, let's attend the examination Monday afternoon. I'd like to see our decorations in daylight." We decided to do so, and also thought of something else. Snow fell all day Sunday, so that on Monday morning, sleighs had to be brought out. Frank and I drove down to the store and invested a considerable share of our spare cash in a variety assortment of knick-knacks. After dinner, we drove through to the Enderley Road schoolhouse, tied our horse in a quiet spot, and went in. Our arrival created quite a sensation, for, as a rule, Blackburn Hillites did not patronize Enderley Road functions. Miss Davis, the pale, tired-looking little teacher, was evidently pleased, and we were given seats of honor next to the minister on the platform. Our decorations really looked very well, and were further enhanced by two large red geraniums in full bloom, which it appeared Maggie had brought from home to adorn the teacher's desk. The side benches were lined with Enderley Road parents, and all the pupils were in their best attire. Our friend Maggie was there, of course, and she smiled and nodded towards the wreaths when she caught our eyes. The examination was a decided success, and the program which followed was very creditable indeed. Maggie and Minnie, in particular, covered themselves with glory, both in class and on the platform. At its close, while the minister was making his speech, Frank slipped out. When the minister sat down, the door opened, and Santa Claus himself, with big fur coat, ruddy mask, and long white beard, strode into the room with a huge basket on his arm, amid a chorus of surprised "Ohs" from old and young. Wonderful things came out of that basket. There was some little present for every child there. Tops, knives, and whistles for the boys, dolls and ribbons for the girls, and a prize box of candy for everybody, all of which Santa Claus presented with appropriate remarks. It was an exciting time, and it would have been hard to decide which were the most pleased, parents, pupils, or teacher. In the confusion, Santa Claus discreetly disappeared, and school was dismissed. Frank, having tucked his toggery away in the sleigh, was waiting for us outside, and we were promptly pounced upon by Maggie and Minnie, whose long braids were already adorned with the pink silk ribbons which had been their gifts. "You decorated the school," cried Maggie excitedly. "I know you did. I told Minnie it was you the minute I saw it." "You're dreaming, child," said Frank. "Oh, no, I'm not," retorted Maggie shrewdly. "And wasn't Matt Dickey mad this morning? Oh, it was such fun. I think you are two real nice boys, and so does Minnie, don't you, Minnie?" Minnie nodded gravely. Evidently, Maggie did the talking in their partnership. "This has been a splendid examination," said Maggie, drawing a long breath. "Real Christmassy, you know. We never had such a good time before." "Well, it has paid, don't you think?" asked Frank as we drove home. "Rather," I answered. "It did pay in other ways than the mere pleasure of it. There was always a better feeling between the Roaders and the Hillites thereafter. The big brothers of the little girls, to whom our Christmas surprise had been such a treat, thought it worthwhile to bury the hatchet, and quarrels between the two villages became things of the past."
That was Rob Filipkowski reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's Christmas on Enderley Road. On with the show. Here's Karen Filipkowski reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's The Unforgotten One.
It was Christmas Eve, but there was no frost or snow or sparkle. It was a green Christmas, and the night was mild and dim with a hazy starlight. A little wind was laughing freakishly among the firs around Ingleside and rustling among the sere grasses along the garden walks. It was more like a night in early spring or late fall than in December, but it was Christmas Eve, and there was a light in every window of Ingleside, the glow breaking out through the whispering darkness like a flame-red blossom swung against the background of the evergreens. For the children were coming home for the Christmas reunion, as they always came, Fritz and Margaret and Laddie and Nora, and Robert's two boys in the place of Robert, who had died 14 years ago. And the old house must put forth its best of light and good cheer to welcome them. Dr. Fritz and his brood were the last to arrive, driving up to the hall door amid a chorus of welcoming barks from the old dogs and a hail of merry calls from the group in the open doorway. "We are all here now," said the little mother as she put her arms about the neck of her stalwart firstborn and kissed his bearded face. There were handshakings and greetings and laughter. Only Nanny, far back in the shadows of the firelit hall, swallowed a resentful sob and wiped two bitter tears from her eyes with her little red hand. "We're not all here," she murmured under her breath. "Miss Avis isn't here. Oh, how can they be so glad? How can they have forgotten?" But nobody heard or heeded Nanny. She was only the little orphan help girl at Ingleside. They were all very good to her, and they were all very fond of her. But at the times of family reunion, Nanny was unconsciously counted out. There was no bond of blood to unite her to them, and she was left on the fringe of things. Nanny never resented this. It was all a matter of course to her. But on this Christmas Eve, her heart was broken because she thought that nobody remembered Miss Avis. After supper, they gathered around the open fireplace of the hall, hung with its berries and evergreens in honor of the morrow. It was their unwritten law to form a fireside circle on Christmas Eve and tell each other what the year had brought them of good and ill, sorrow and joy. The circle was smaller by one than it had been the year before, but none spoke of that. There was a smile on every face and happiness in every voice. The father and mother sat in the center, gray-haired and placid, their fine old faces written over with the history of gracious lives. Beside the mother, Dr. Fritz sat like a boy, on the floor with his massive head, gray as his father's, on her lap, and one of his smooth, muscular hands that were as tender as a woman's at the operating table, clasped in hers. Next to him sat sweet Nora, the 20-year-old baby, who taught in a city school The rosy firelight gleamed lovingly over her girlish beauty of burnished brown hair, dreamy blue eyes, and soft, virginal curves of her cheek and throat. Dr. Fritz's spare arm was about her, but Nora's own hands were clasped over her knee, and on one of them sparkled a diamond that had not been there at the last Christmas reunion. Laddie, who figured as Archibald only in the family Bible, sat close to the inglenook, a handsome young fellow with a daring brow and rollicking eyes. On the other side sat Margaret, hand in hand with her father, a woman whose gracious sweetness of nature enveloped her as a garment. And Robert's two laughing boys filled up the circle, looking so much alike that it was hard to say which was Cecil and which was Sid. Margaret's husband and Fritz's wife were playing games with the children in the parlor, whence the shrieks of merriment drifted out into the hall. Nanny might have been with them had she chosen, but she preferred to sit alone in the darkest corner of the hall and gaze with jealous, unhappy eyes at the mirthful group about the fire, listening to their story in jest and laughter with unavailing protest in her heart. Oh, how could they have forgotten so soon? It was not yet a full year since Miss Avis had gone. Last Christmas Eve she had sat there, a sweet and saintly presence in the inglenook, more so it had seemed, the center of the home circle than the father and mother. And now the December stars were shining over her grave, and not one of that heedless group remembered her. Not once was her name spoken. Even her old dog had forgotten her. He sat with his nose in Margaret's lap, blinking with drowsy, aged contentment at the fire. "Oh, I can't bear it," whispered Nanny under cover of the hearty laughter which greeted a story Dr. Fritz had been telling. She slipped out into the kitchen, put on her hood and cloak, and took from a box under the table a little wreath of holly. She had made it out of the bits left over from the decorations. Miss Avis had loved holly. Miss Avis had loved every green growing thing. As Nanny opened the kitchen door, something cold touched her hand, and there stood the old dog, wagging his tail and looking up at her with wistful eyes, mutely pleading to be taken too. "So, you do remember her, Jippy," said Nanny, patting his head. "Come along, then. We'll go together." They slipped out into the night. It was quite dark, but it was not far to the graveyard, just out through the evergreens and along a field bypath and across the road. The old church was there with its square tower and the white stones gleaming all around it. Nanny went straight to a shadowy corner and knelt on the sere grasses while she placed her holly wreath on Miss Avis's grave. The tears in her eyes brimmed over. "Oh, Miss Avis, she sobbed. I miss you so. It can't ever seem like Christmas to me without you. You were always so sweet and kind to me. There ain't a day passes but I think of you and all the things you used to say to me. And I try to be good like you'd want me to be. But I hate them for forgetting you. Yes, I do. I'll never forget you, darling Miss Avis. I'd rather be here alone with you in the dark than back there with them." Nanny sat down by the grave. The old dog lay down by her side with his forepaws on the turf and his eyes fixed on the tall white marble shaft. It was too dark for Nanny to read the inscription, but she knew every word of it. "In loving remembrance of Avis Maywood, died January 20, 1902, aged 45. And underneath the lines of her own choosing, "Say not good night, but in some brighter clime bid me good morning." But they had forgotten her. Oh, they had forgotten her already. When half an hour had passed, Nanny was startled by approaching footsteps. Not wishing to be seen, she crept softly behind the headstones into the shadow of the willow on the farther side, and the old dog followed. Dr. Fritz, coming to the grave, thought himself alone with the dead. He knelt down by the headstone and pressed his face against it. "Avis," he said gently, "dear Avis, I have come to visit your grave tonight because you seem nearer to me here than elsewhere. And I want to talk to you, Avis, as I have always talked to you every Christmastide since we were children together. I have missed you so tonight, dear friend and sympathizer. No words can tell how I have missed you, your welcoming hand clasp and your sweet face in the firelight shadows. I could not bear to speak your name. The aching sense of loss was so bitter. Amid all the Christmas mirth and good fellowship, I felt the sorrow of your vacant chair. Avis, I wanted to tell you what this year had brought to me. My theory has been proved. It has made me a famous man. Last Christmas, Avis, I told you of it, and you listened and understood and believed in it. Dear Avis, once again, I thank you for all you have been to me, all you are yet. I have brought you your roses. They are white and pure and fragrant as your life. Other footsteps came so quickly on Dr. Fritz's retreating ones that Nanny could not rise. It was Laddie this time, gay, careless, thoughtless Laddie. Roses! So Fritz has been here. I have brought you lilies, Avis. Oh, Avis, I miss you so. You were so jolly and good. You understood a fellow so well. I had to come here tonight to tell you how much I miss you. It doesn't seem half home without you. Avis, I'm trying to be a better chap, more the sort of man you'd have me be. I've given the old set the go-by. I'm trying to live up to your standard. It would be easier if you were here to help me. When I was a kid, it was always easier to be good for a while after I'd talk things over with you. I've got the best mother a fellow ever had, but you and I were such chums, weren't we, Avis? I thought I'd just break down in there tonight and put a damper on everything by crying like a baby. If anybody had spoken about you, I should have. Hello? Laddie wheeled around with a start, but it was only Robert's two boys who came shyly up to the grave, half hanging back to find anyone else there. Hello, boys, said Laddie huskily. So you've come to see your grave, too. Yes, said Cecil solemnly. We just had to. We couldn't go to bed without coming. Oh, isn't it lonesome without Cousin Avis? She was always so good to us, said Sid. She used to talk to us so nice, said Cecil chokily. But she liked fun, too. Boys, said Laddie gravely, never forget what Cousin Avis used to say to you. Never forget that you have got to grow up into men she'd be proud of. They went away then, the boys and their boyish uncle, and when they had gone, Nora came out, stealing timidly through the shadows, startling at the rustle of the wind in the trees. Oh, Avis, she whispered, I want to see you so much. I want to tell you all about it, about him. You would understand so well. He is the best and dearest lover ever a girl had. You would think so, too. Oh, Avis, how I miss you so much. There's a little shadow even on my happiness, because I can't talk it over with you in the old way. Oh, Avis, it was dreadful to sit around the fire tonight and not see you. Perhaps you were there in spirit. I love to think you were, but I wanted to see you. You were always there to come home to before, Avis, dear. Sobbing, she went away, and then came Margaret, the grave, strong Margaret. Dear cousin, dear to me as a sister, it seemed to me that I must come to you here tonight. I cannot tell you how much I miss your wise, clear-sighted advice and judgment, your wholesome companionship. A little son was born to me this past year, Avis. How glad you would have been, for you knew, as none other did, the bitterness in my childless heart. How we would have delighted to talk over my baby together and teach him wisely between us. Avis, Avis, your going made a blank that can never be filled for me. Margaret was still standing there when the old people came. Father, mother, isn't it too late and chilly for you to be here? No, Margaret, no, said the mother. I couldn't go to my bed without coming to see Avis's grave. I brought her up from a baby her dying mother gave her to me. She was as much my own child as any of you, and oh, I miss her so. You only miss her when you come home, but I miss her all the time, every day. We all miss her, mother, said the old father tremulously. She was a good girl, Avis was a good girl. Good night, Avis. Say not good night, but in some brighter clime, bid her good morning, quoted Margaret softly. That was her own wish, you know. Let us go back now. It is getting late. When they had gone, Annie crept out from the shadows. It had not occurred to her that perhaps she should not have listened. She had been too shy to make her presence known to those who came to Avis's grave. But her heart was full of joy. Oh, Miss Avis, I am so glad, I am so glad. They haven't forgotten you after all, Miss Avis, dear. Not one of them. I'm sorry I was so cross at them. And I'm so glad they haven't forgotten you. And I love them for it. Then the old dog and Nanny went home together.
That was Karen Filipkowski reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's The Unforgotten One. Now, just one more before we take a short break. Here's Mark Wormke reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's Christmas at Red Butte.
Of course Santa Claus will come, said Jimmy Martin confidently. Jimmy was 10, and at 10 it's easy to be confident. Why, he's got to come, because it's Christmas Eve, and he always has come. You know that, twins. Yes, the twins knew it, and cheered by Jimmy's superior wisdom, their doubts passed away. There had been one terrible moment when Theodora had sighed and told them they mustn't be too disappointed if Santa Claus did not come this year because the crops had been poor and he mightn't have had enough presents to go around. That doesn't make any difference to Santa Claus, scoffed Jimmy. You know as well as I do, Theodora Prentice, that Santa Claus is rich whether the crops fail or not. They failed 3 years ago before Father died, but Santa Claus came all the same. Probably you don't remember it, twins, because you were too little, but I do. Of course he'll come, so don't you worry a mite, and he'll bring my skates and your dolls. He knows we're expecting them, Theodora, because we wrote him a letter last week and threw it up the chimney. And there'll be candy and nuts, of course, and Mother's gone to town to buy a turkey. I tell you, we're going to have a ripping Christmas. Well, don't use such slangy words about it, Jimmy boy, sighed Theodora. She couldn't bear to dampen their hopes any further, and perhaps Aunt Elizabeth might manage it if the colt sold well. But Theodora had her painful doubts, and she sighed again as she looked out of the window far down the trail that wound across the prairie, red-lighted by the declining sun of the short wintry afternoon. "Do people always sigh like that when they get to be 16?" asked Jimmy curiously. "You didn't sigh like that when you were only 15, Theodora. I wish you wouldn't. It makes me feel funny. And it's not a nice kind of funniness either." It's a bad habit I've gotten into lately, said Theodora, trying to laugh. Old folks are dull sometimes, you know, Jimmy boy. 16 is awfully old, isn't it? Said Jimmy reflectively. I'll tell you what I'm going to do when I'm 16, Theodora. I'm going to pay off the mortgage and buy Mother a silk dress and a piano for the twins. Won't that be elegant? I'll be able to do that because I'm a man. Of course, if I was only a girl, I couldn't. I hope you'll be a good, kind, brave man and a real help to your mother, said Theodora softly, sitting down before the cozy fire and lifting the fat little twins onto her lap. Oh, I'll be good to her, never you fear, assured Jimmy, squatting comfortably down on the little fur rug before the stove, the skin of the coyote his father had killed 4 years ago. I believe in being good to your mother when you've only got the one. Now tell us a story, Theodora, a real jolly story, you know, with lots of fighting in it. Only please don't kill anybody. I like to hear about fighting, but I like to have all the people come out alive. Theodora laughed and began a story about the Riel Rebellion of 1885, a story which had the double merit of being true and exciting at the same time. It was quite dark when she finished, and the twins were nodding, but Jimmy's eyes were wide open and sparkling.
That was great, he said, drawing a long breath. Tell us another.
No, it's bedtime for you all, said Theodora firmly. One story at a time is my rule, you know.
But I want to sit up until Mother comes home, objected Jimmy.
You can't. She may be very late, for she would have to wait to see Mr. Porter. Besides, you don't know what time Santa Claus might come, if he comes at all. If he were to drive along and see you children up instead of being sound asleep in bed, he might go right on and never call at all.
This argument was too much for Jimmy.
All right, we'll go, but we have to hang up our stockings first. Twins, get yours.
The twins toddled off in great excitement and brought back their Sunday stockings, which Jimmy proceeded to hang along the edge of the mantel shelf. This done, they all trooped obediently off to bed. Theodora gave another sigh and seated herself at the window where she could watch the moonlit prairie for Mrs. Martin's homecoming and knit at the same time. I'm afraid that you will think from all the sighing Theodora was doing that she was a very melancholy and despondent young lady. You couldn't think anything more unlike the real Theodora. She was the jolliest, bravest girl of 16 in all Saskatchewan, as her shining brown eyes and rosy dimpled cheeks would have told you, and her sighs were not on her own account, but simply for fear the children were going to be disappointed. She knew that they would be almost heartbroken if Santa Claus did not come, and that this would hurt their patient, hard-working little mother more than all else. 5 years before this, Theodora had come to live with Uncle George and Aunt Elizabeth in the little log house at Red Butte. Her own mother had just died, and Theodora had only her big brother Donald left, and Donald had Klondike fever. The Martins were poor, but they had gladly made room for their little niece, and Theodora had lived there ever since, her aunt's right-hand girl and the beloved playmate of the children. They had been very happy until Uncle George's death 2 years before this Christmas Eve, but since then there had been hard times in the little log house, and though Mrs. Martin and Theodora did their best, it was a woefully hard task to make ends meet, especially this year when their crops had been poor. Theodora and her aunt had made every sacrifice possible for the children's sake, and at least Jimmy and the twins had not felt the pinch very severely yet. At 7, Mrs. Martin's bells jingled at the door, and Theodora flew out. "Go right in and get warm, Auntie," she said briskly. "I'll take Ned away and unharness him." "It's a bitterly cold night," said Mrs. Martin wearily. There was a note of discouragement in her voice that struck dismay to Theodora's heart. "I'm afraid it means no Christmas for the children tomorrow," Theodora thought sadly as she led Ned away to the stable. When she returned to the kitchen, Mrs. Martin was sitting by the fire, her face in her chilled hand, sobbing convulsively. "Auntie, oh, Auntie, don't!" exclaimed Theodora impulsively. It was such a rare thing to see her plucky, resolute little aunt in tears. "You're cold and tired. I'll have a nice cup of tea for you in a trice." "No, it isn't that," said Mrs. Martin brokenly. "It was seeing those stockings hanging there. Theodora, I couldn't get a thing for the children. Not a single thing. Mr. Porter would only give $40 for the colt, and when all the bills were paid, there was barely enough left for such necessaries as we must have. I suppose I ought to feel thankful I could get those, but the thought of the children's disappointment tomorrow is more than I can bear. It would have been better to have told them long ago, but I kept building on getting more for the colt. Well, it's weak and foolish to give way like this. We'd better both take a cup of tea and go to bed. It will save fuel." When Theodora went up to her little room, her face was very thoughtful. She took a small box from her table and carried it to the window. In it was a very pretty little gold locket hung on a narrow blue ribbon. Theodora held it tenderly in her fingers and looked out over the moonlit prairie with a very sober face. Could she give up her dear locket, the locket Donald had given her just before he started out for the Klondike? She had never thought she could do such a thing. It was almost the only thing she had to remind her of Donald. Handsome, merry, impulsive, warm-hearted Donald, who had gone away 4 years ago with a smile on his bonny face and a splendid hope in his heart. "Here's a locket for you, gift of God," he had said gaily. He had such a dear, loving habit of calling her by the beautiful meaning of her name. A lump came into Theodora's throat as she remembered it. "I couldn't afford a chain, too, but when I come back, I'll bring you a rope of Klondike nuggets for it." Then he had gone away. For 2 years, letters had come from him regularly. Then he wrote that he had joined a prospecting party to a remote wilderness. After that was silence, deepening into anguish of suspense that finally ended in hopelessness. A rumor came that Donald Prentice was dead. None had returned from the expedition he had joined. Theodora had long ago given up all hope of ever seeing Donald again. Hence her locket was doubly dear to her. But Aunt Elizabeth had always been so good and loving and kind to her. Could she not make this sacrifice for her sake? Yes, she could and would. Theodora flung up her head with a gesture that meant decision. She took out of the locket the bits of hair, her mother's and Donald's, which it contained. Perhaps a tear or two fell as she did so, and then hastily donned her warmest cap and wraps.
It was only 3 miles to Spencer. She could easily walk it in an hour, and as it was Christmas Eve, the shops would be open late. She must walk, for Ned could not be taken out again, and the mare's foot was sore. Besides, Aunt Elizabeth must not know until it was done. As stealthily as if she were bound on some nefarious errand, Theodora slipped downstairs and out of the house. The next minute, she was hurrying along the trail in the moonlight. The great dazzling prairie was around her, the mystery and splendor of the northern night all about her. It was very calm and cold, but Theodora walked so briskly that she kept warm. The trail from Red Butte to Spencer was a lonely one. Mr. Lurgan's house, halfway to town, was the only dwelling on it. When Theodora reached Spencer, she made her way at once to the only jewelry store the little town contained. Mr. Benson, its owner, had been a friend of her uncle's, and Theodora felt sure that he would buy her locket. Nevertheless, her heart beat quickly, and her breath came and went uncomfortably fast as she went in. Suppose he wouldn't buy it. Then there would be no Christmas for the children at Red Butte. "Good evening, Miss Theodora," said Mr. Benson briskly. "What can I do for you?" "I'm afraid I'm not a very welcome sort of customer, Mr. Benson," said Theodora with an uncertain smile. "I want to sell, not buy. Could you, will you buy this locket?" Mr. Benson pursed up his lips and took the locket and examined it. "Well, I don't often buy second-hand stuff," he said, after some reflection. "But I don't mind obliging you, Miss Theodora. I'll give you $4 for this trinket." Theodora knew the locket had cost a great deal more than that, but $4 would get what she wanted, and she dared not ask for more. In a few minutes, the locket was in Mr. Benson's possession, and Theodora, with 4 crisp new bills in her purse, was hurrying to the toy store. Half an hour later, she was on her way back to Red Butte with as many parcels as she could carry. Jimmy's skates, 2 lovely dolls for the twins, packages of nuts and candy, and a nice plump turkey. Theodora beguiled her lonely tramp by picturing the children's joy in the morning. About a quarter of a mile past Mr. Lurgan's house, the trail curved suddenly about a bluff of poplars. As Theodora rounded the turn, she halted in amazement. Almost at her feet, the body of a man was lying across the road. He was clad in a big fur coat and had a fur cap pulled well down over his forehead and ears. Almost all of him that could be seen was a full, bushy beard. Theodora had no idea who he was or where he had come from, but she realized that he was unconscious and that he would speedily freeze to death if help were not brought. The footprints of a horse galloping across the prairie suggested a fall and a runaway, but Theodora did not waste time in speculation. She ran back at full speed to Mr. Lurgan's and roused the household. In a few minutes, Mr. Lurgan and his son had hitched a horse to a wood sleigh and hurried down the trail to the unfortunate man. Theodora, knowing that her assistance was not needed and that she ought to get home as quickly as possible, went on her way as soon as she had seen the stranger in safekeeping. When she reached the little log house, she crept in cautiously, put the children's gifts in their stockings, placed the turkey on the table where Aunt Elizabeth would see it first thing in the morning, and then slipped off to bed, a very weary but very happy girl. The joy that reigned in the little log house the next day more than repaid Theodora for her sacrifice. "Whoopee! Didn't I tell you that Santa Claus would come all right?" shouted the delighted Jimmy. "Oh, what splendid skates!" The twins hugged their dolls in silent rapture, but Aunt Elizabeth's face was the best of all. Then the dinner had to be prepared, and everybody had a hand in that. Just as Theodora, after a grave peep into the oven, had announced that the turkey was done, a sleigh dashed around the house. Theodora flew to answer the knock at the door, and there stood Mr. Lurgan, and a big, bewhiskered, fur-coated fellow whom Theodora recognized as the stranger she had found on the trail. But was he a stranger? There was something oddly familiar in those merry brown eyes. Theodora felt herself growing dizzy. "Donald!" she gasped. "Oh, Donald!" And then she was in the big fellow's arms, laughing and crying at the same time. Donald it was indeed, and then followed half an hour during which everybody talked at once, and the turkey would have been burned to a crisp had it not been for the presence of mind of Mr. Lurgan, who, being the least excited of them all, took it out of the oven and set it on the back of the stove. "To think that it was you last night, and that I never dreamed it," exclaimed Theodora. "Oh, Donald, if I hadn't gone to town." "I'd have frozen to death, I'm afraid," said Donald soberly. "I got into Spencer on the last train last night. I felt that I must come right out. I couldn't wait till morning. But there wasn't a team to be got for love or money. It was Christmas Eve and all the livery rigs were out. So I came on horseback. Just by that bluff, something frightened my horse and he shied violently. I was half asleep and thinking of my little sister, and I went off like a shot. I suppose I struck my head against a tree. Anyway, I knew nothing more until I came to in Mr. Lurgan's kitchen. I wasn't much hurt, feel none the worse of it except for a sore head and shoulder. But, oh, gift of God, how you have grown! I can't realize that you were my little sister I left 4 years ago. I suppose you've been thinking I was dead. Yes, and oh, Donald, where have you been? Well, I went way up north with a prospecting party. We had a tough time the first year, I can tell you, and some of us never came back. We weren't in a country where post offices were lying round loose either, you see. Then, at last, just as we were about giving up in despair, we struck it rich. I've brought a snug little pile home with me, and things are going to look up in this log house, gift to God. There'll be no more worrying for you dear people over mortgages. I'm so glad for Auntie's sake, said Theodora with shining eyes. But oh, Donald, it's the best of all just to have you back. I'm so perfectly happy that I don't know what to do or say. Well, I think you might have some dinner, said Jimmy in an injured tone. The turkey's getting stone cold and I'm almost starving. I just can't stand it another minute. So with a laugh, they all sat down to the table and ate the merriest Christmas dinner the little log house had ever known.
That was Mark Wormke reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's Christmas at Red Butte. Time now for a short break, but we'll be right back with more of Lucy Maud Montgomery's Christmas stories. See you on the other side.